Thanks for the nice intro, Bill. Before I get started, I'd just like to wish all the mothers out there a very, very happy Mother's Day. You know, that is the toughest job that God ever created. And, you know, there is no love like a mother's love for her children. And I know that God loves us all, but I do believe that he has a very special place for the mothers of this world. I'm Kenny. I'm an alcoholic. And as Bill mentioned to you, my home group is the Springfield Alano Group. We are the oldest group between Chicago and St. Louis. And I attend there quite regularly. Sobriety is my most important possession. It is the greatest gift that has ever been given to me, and I truly cherish it. You know, it is my sound opinion that the people from our southern states are the most friendly people in the world. You know, you even have the Hawaiians beat, and they're very friendly people. You know, a couple of quick stories about my experiences in the South. First time I ever came down this way was in 1965, and I was working for the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company selling group insurance plans, and I had the occasion to have to go to Calhoun, Georgia. So I flew into Atlanta and rented a car, went up to Calhoun, and I stayed in this little hotel, you know, like the old days where you just pulled in and the little pool was out in front and you parked your car right in front of the room and you put the quarters in the TV so you could, you know, watch the TV. And when I checked in, I got in my room and I'm in there not more than maybe 10 minutes or so, and there's a knock on the door and there's a lady there, and she says, "I'm checking to see if you have all your tiles in here." I said, "All right, let me look." So I looked on the floor and the bathroom wall and the ceiling and everything, and I says, "They're all here." And then about half hour later, I'm getting ready to take a shower, and I don't have any towels. And in the morning when I'm checking out, she says, "Oh, don't worry, my dog won't bite you." And I says, "Well, listen, if that's a dog, what do you call a hog?" She says, "Well, that's a hog." She says, "If you weren't so cute, it'd be sad, you know." And about 5 years ago, I hired a young lady from Arkadelphia, Arkansas, and to work in my office. And everybody knew that I was a kidder. I love to have fun with my employees, and I'm always joking with them and that. And she was telling me about all the wild pigs that run the plains in Arkansas, and they have these big tusks, and they're just dangerous as heck, you know. And I says, "Man," I says, "yeah, that's right, the Arkansas Razorbacks." And I was just thinking about that. And then I had the occasion to go down to Little Rock to kind of oversee our office for a couple weeks because the manager we had down there just took off with one of the ladies from his office. So, and they had a lot of armed service down there, so they wanted me to go down and kind of take it over and hire somebody and get them going and everything. So I was going down to Arkansas, and when I was leaving, she says, "Now you watch out for those pigs." And I said, "I will, you know." So I'm driving down. I'm just a little bit further south than Clayton and Laura there in our Blytheville. And I'm filling my car up at the gas station, and next to me is Arkansas State Policeman. I said, "Hi, how you doing?" He says, "Hi." And I said to him, I said, "How far into the state do you have to go before you see all those wild pigs?" And he says, "Let me tell you," he says, "we really ought to have something when people come into the state, you know, as a warning. But," he says, "you get a flat tire around here or anything, you don't get out of your car to fix it or anything." He says, "Because they'll get you." He says, "I had me a girlfriend once, and she got out to fix her flat tire, and all they found was a pair of Adidas." And then he starts laughing at me, and he says, "Where are you from?" And he's looking, turns around, looks at my license plate, and he says, "Come on, I'll buy you a cup of coffee." So, I mean, I've just had wonderful experiences with the people in the South. Milton called me a couple of times, and he left a message on my recorder, and my wife plays it over and over because she loves it so much. Yeah. I says, you ought to meet his wife. Yeah, I said, I was telling her last night, I says, "You would love this." I says, "Everyone is just so warm and friendly." Yeah, I've been in meetings, you know, all over the place, and never have I been in one like this that actually makes me feel as though I'm talking to my home group. and it really makes me feel good inside. Yeah. You know, I was, I'm from Chicago. I was born in 1944 in Evergreen Park, Illinois. I'm from an Irish Catholic family, and my whole family on both sides came over from Ireland. We're all from Galway Bay, Dingle Bay area on the west coast of the Emerald Isle. And all my relatives and family were Chicago policemen, Chicago firemen, Chicago garbage men. Everybody worked for the city. And when everybody retired, they all went back to Ireland. You know, everybody went back. But I am the oldest of, there's seven of us. It was Kenny, Denny, Patty, Peggy, Kathy, Mickey, and Nancy. And every time my father took me and Denny to the show and dropped us off on Saturday, we were expecting another brother or sister. And it got to the point where when my father would take us to the show, I asked him once, I said, "We're going to have a new brother and sister when we get home?" You know, because it seems like my mother was constantly, you know, constantly pregnant. You know, God bless my mother. I lost her many years ago, but you know, she taught me a lot of things that that you don't learn in school. She taught me how to open a car door for a woman, how to hold her arm. She taught me how to dance because they didn't teach anything like that in school. And she taught me how to be a gentleman, and I was her helper, and she was a great lady. And I remember her always, but especially you know, on a day like today, on Mother's Day. You know, I had a really marvelous childhood. We moved around quite a bit. My father was in management, and in the late 40s, we moved to Zanesville, Ohio, and several of my sisters were born there. And we moved back to Chicago in the mid-50s, and went to grammar school in Chicago, and then I went to high school out in Chicago Heights, Illinois, which is a far suburb of Chicago. When we moved to the suburbs in the late 50s. When I was going to high school, I participated in everything you could get your hands on. You know, I played football. I didn't play any basketball, but I played baseball. I golfed. And the thing that I liked probably the most was I was in the theater group, and I loved doing shows, musicals, you know, anything like that that had to do with the arts. I just loved it. And it was something that I excelled in, and I really enjoyed it. I didn't do any drinking at all in high school. The only time that I ever had anything to drink in high school was after our senior prom, and we all chipped in and bought some beer, and we went to the beach, and everybody got drunk, and I didn't like it, and it was something that I just didn't care that much about. When I went to college, again, I did very little drinking. I was all business. During high school and college, sometimes the nuns when I had in high school and the professors, they'd say, "Ken, where are your books?" I said, "I don't need any books. I pay attention in school." You know, and it really worked because just about everything you needed to know was taught to you. And if you paid attention instead of fooling around with the girls or doing these silly things that we used to do in class, you really didn't need to do a whole lot of homework because you were prepared. And I was very fortunate that I guess I was, you know, at least I thought I was smart. But if I paid attention in school, I could get straight A's. And I did real well in school and went to college. And I actually went to and took the law school examination for John Marshall and passed it. And went to John Marshall Law School for 8 days. And I decided I had enough school. You could tell I was really dedicated, yeah. And the professor says, "Aren't you going to even try?" I said, "Well, I did. I've been here a week, you know." And but I was too busy, you know, doing other things. You know, I had two rock groups that I was in. You know, I played the guitar and had two rock groups. We did that. I always liked fast cars, so I had a couple of real fast cars, and almost every money I made went into the cars, you know. And you know, I was constantly into girlfriends. There just wasn't enough women in the world, and I was really worried that you know how would I live long enough to be able to get around to all of them. You know, it took me a long time to figure out that ain't ever going to happen. Yeah. You know? But at that stage of the game, I thought for some reason I might be able to pull it off, you know. But it's amazing what we think of when we're, you know, when we're in our youth. But at that particular point in time, you know, the Vietnam War was starting to escalate. And when I lost my school status, I knew I'd be drafted. So I went, and it was very easy at that time. I just walked down and enlisted in the Illinois National Guard. And I took a bunch of tests and so forth, and they tried to talk me into going to officer's candidate school, and I said, no, I don't want to do that. And so I decided that I would go in for fire direction control, which was, you know, how to aim the azimuth on the big guns and stuff like this. So I was supposed to go to Fort Campbell for basic training. I mean, Fort Knox, but I ended up in Fort Campbell with the 101st, had to go through jump school, everything else, and they finally got it straightened out, and they sent me to Fort Sill, where I should have gone in the first place. So I was a fire direction control person for the 105s, the 155s, and the 8-inch guns. And at that point in time, they did talk me into going to OCS. I went to OCS and got a commission as a second lieutenant, and then rejoined my guard unit. During that period of time, having always liked the arts, I went up to Northwestern University, because I had spent a lot of time at NU, and I went and saw a ballet called The Red Shoes. I would always have to go by myself because none of my friends liked a lot of the things that I liked because, you know, they thought maybe it might be a little feminine. But I like stuff like that. I like the opera, I like the ballet, I like the plays, I like all that stuff. So I go up there to watch this show. And the little star of the show was the most pretty little blonde ballerina that I had ever seen. And I was just spellbound by this gal. So after the show, I ran across to the hotel there in Evanston and got some flowers and took them back. And I said, I want to give this to the gal. And she's right there. And she says, well, who are you? I says, I'm the guy you're going to marry. Well, they called the cops on me, you know. And they didn't arrest me, but they just told me, hey, you know, you cannot do stuff like that. You know, it's just not right. Well, I found out who she was, and I called her a couple of days later. And I apologized to her. I says, I was just so overwhelmed by you. Not only your performance, but your whole persona. You know, I just had to, you know. And I says, could I meet you for a cup of coffee in a public place or something? And she actually agreed to meet me. So I went up to Evanston and met her for a cup of coffee. And she told me that she had a boyfriend of long standing. But she thanked me for my interest and so forth. And I accepted that, you know, at that time. But that's how that started. I did end up marrying her, though. But at that time, I says, "Well, I have to find some sort of regular employment." So I really wanted to get into sales or some kind of public relations or anything like that. And I remember when I was in high school, I had a good buddy by the name of Gary Wojcik, and his father was a real big shot with the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, and he used to tell me, he says, "Kenny, if you ever want a job, you come and see me." So I called him up and I says, "Mr. Wojcik," I says, "what would I have to do to come to work for you?" So he talked to me and he sent me here. He sent me to New York, and they decided they were going to put me in group insurance sales. So we would go different places throughout the country and we would sell group insurance plans. And one day I was in New York City, and we were selling group insurance policies in New York City, and I walked into the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency. And when I got in there, you know, I asked to talk to the big wigs, and I wanted to talk to them all, you know. And I always approached it like, you know, I'm going to do you a favor, you know, and you're gonna really, you know, appreciate this because your employees are going to love you. You're going to save money for the company. And I says, most people don't change their insurances because they associate it with a lot of work and effort and everything, and we take care of everything, you know. So I told the whole sales bill and everything else. I go back the next day to another appointment with them. They says, well, when can you start? I says, oh, boy, I got the sale. He says, no, we want you to work for us. I says, doing what? So they told me what I was going to be doing. You know, they're going to give me a company car and expense account, and I was going to be thinking up stuff. And I was, oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. That's what I'll do. So I go call my boss, say, yeah, I'm done. Yeah. So I had this job, and I was a junior account exec in training, and it didn't take me long to work my way up. But I remember, forget the first day on the job. And here I am in New York City, and I got to the office early that morning. They told me to be there at 8. I was there at 7:30. And my boss came in, I don't know, about 5 after 8. And he said, come on in. Go in his office, got this big office. And we're sitting there, and he gets out all the paperwork we have to fill out, you know, your W-2s and all that stuff. And his secretary comes in. She had on the tightest dress and the highest heel shoes that I ever saw, and she barely made it across the office carrying this tray. You know, and he's eyeing her up and this and that. He says, well, you look good. You look a lot better in that outfit, you know. And she says, yeah, I know. This is what you told me I had to have. You know, and I'm sitting there and I'm watching this. Well, anyway, she brings in the coffee. She sets it down and she leaves. He walks over there and he opens up this cabinet and he poured something from a bottle. And I thought to myself, God, I think that's some kind of booze, you know. And in his coffee, and he says, you want some? I says, no, I just use regular cream. I didn't know what else to say. I didn't want to criticize my boss, you know, on the very first minute of the job, you know. So, you know, he's there drinking this whatever it was. You know, I didn't know what it was. It turned out it was Benedictine, which I had no idea what Benedictine was. So we filled all this paperwork out and everything else, and it was like 10 o'clock, time for lunch. So we walk over to the Waldorf Astoria, and we go with about 6 of other guys, and none of them were very close in my age. Maybe the next closest person, I was about 22, maybe, 22, yeah, probably 22, and would have probably been in his maybe early 30s. So we sit at this round table in the Waldorf, and the waiter comes over, and everyone's ordering their drinks that I had never really even heard of. Southern Comfort Manhattans, you know, Beefeater Gibsons, Beefeater Martinis, this and that, and they get around to me. I says, I'll have a highball. You know, that's all I knew was, the, you know, highball. I was not a very worldly person when it came to stuff like that. And they says, oh, for God's sakes, give the kid a decent drink, you know. So I said, well, I guess I'll have one of those. The guy sitting next to me was drinking a martini. So I get this martini, and I took a sip of it. I thought, oh, my God. You know, there's no way in the world I'm going to be able to drink this. It's absolutely horrible. You know? And I'm thinking, oh, man. So I finally, you know, so grateful. It was practically gone. And boom, there's another one, you know, sitting right in front of me. And then I drank that one. And then there's another one there. And then the fourth one came, and we hadn't even ordered lunch yet. And I said to my boss, I says, hey, and his name was Charlie. I says, Charlie, I says, if I drink this, there's no way I'm going to be able to do any work. I says, I'm not even certain I could stand up and go to the bathroom. You know, I mean, I was rocking. You know, I'd never had anything like that before in my life. He says, look, he says, you're going to have to work on this. And you're gonna have practice. So he says, finish that drink. He says, if you don't feel good, you can lay down in the office somewhere. You know. So I downed that drink, and finally we did eat something. You know, and we went back to the office, and he told me, he says, practice up on that. He says, because you're really gonna need that, you know, for your work. So I go home to visit my folks for a few days, and I didn't know how to make any of this stuff. So I went to the liquor store, and they had the Hublin used to make like pre-mixed martinis and stuff like this. So I bought a bunch of that stuff and put it in the ice box. My mother says, Kenny, what the heck is this? I said, well, I'm practicing, Mom. It's like home. It's like homework. You know, I says, which it actually was. You know, I had to be able to go out with my customers and boot these things down and yet still be, you know, in control. So I practiced up on that. And, you know, probably in 6 to 8 months, you know, I could probably drink 12 or maybe even 15 martinis, and you really wouldn't know that I had any. You know, and I had real good control over this stuff. But the only thing is that I noticed what it did was You know, I was always a very outgoing person to begin with, but this was like rocket fuel. Yeah. It was like rocket fuel. And I found out that I literally could do almost anything with this rocket fuel. And, you know, and then I developed what I call almost like the Midas touch. Absolutely everything that I touched for about a 6 or 7 year period just changed into gold. You know, it just turned into gold. It wasn't long before I was, you know, a senior account exec. I had my own staff. We were making money hand over fist. You know, and by the time I was there 2 years, I made more than the president did. You know, and this was in the 60s, and was well into the six figures. And I just could not believe, you know, that I was making that kind of money. The people that I went to law school with, you know, they asked me if they could borrow some money for their office furniture when they got out of law school. I said, I'll just buy it for you. You know, you know. I says, I'm glad I wasn't no lawyer, you know. and everything was just hunky-dory, you know. But meanwhile, you know, I decided I was going to, when I was home, I decided I'd go out and I'd visit the Metropolitan Life Office where I knew a couple people there. And one of the guys was having a hard time balancing his account. He was a debit agent, and they used to have to balance their books every month, and I kind of helped him. And I'm going through the pages there, and I happen to see the name, and it was her name, the ballerina. And I says, is she still single? He says, yeah. He says, have you seen her? I says, uh-huh. Yeah. And I drove over there, and she was actually sitting outside of her front house. I got out of the car and slammed the door. I says, you still single? She says, yeah. I says, well, I ain't taking no for an answer. Yeah. I says, I'll be back here. It's 8 o'clock tonight. You be ready. And we went back, and, you know, and I flat out right asked her to marry me, you know. And it took her a couple of days to agree, you know. But, I was crazy about that gal, you know. Then I had to figure, how am I going to get back, you know, into the Chicagoland area? But, you know, I figured I could work on that. During my course of my advertising business, I had a couple of occasions to work with a company called the Diamond Match Company, the Diamond International Corporation. And we used the book match advertising in some of our campaigns for like the airlines and things like this. So they wanted me to go to work for them. And I could headquarter in Chicago, even though their headquarters were in New York. So I left J. Walter, went to work for Diamond National Corporation as their general sales manager, even though I did get back to New York, you know, once every 10 days or so for meetings, so I could live in Chicago. And I started, at that point in time, I was used to drinking, so what I did was, I started asking, you know, our prospects and accounts to lunch every day, because the company would pay for our lunch if we had a customer. So I decided, why pay for my own lunch? I'll just take someone to lunch, and I can drink for free, and they can drink for free, and everything else. So we started doing that, and I used to, you know, at the end of the day, I would always stop for a drink. But now I decided, well, you know, I probably, once I have lunch, that's the end of the day. I'll just keep drinking the rest of the day. So that's what I did. And during these course of times, why I met an Irishman fresh on the boat who was starting a new construction business, and we were talking about houses, and he says, I'll build you a house. He says, I need to get started. He says, I'll build you a wonderful house, and I'll take practically nothing for it, you know. So I looked through these Better Homes and Gardens, and we also found one that I really liked, and I showed it to him, and he says, I can build you that house. And we went out and found the land, so I decided I was going to build this house, and I didn't tell her about it yet. So we built this big, beautiful house, and every time that we would go, I mean, that house is still the nicest house in the whole town, and it's been almost 40 some years ago. But we put everything in it. It had 16-foot ceilings and 4 bedrooms and a couple fireplaces, and it had the ice melters under the driveway. When I was in a bar one day, I met a Mobot salesman. And what a Mobot was is, they, before you sod your grass, you put the electric tracks underneath the sod and everything else. Then you just put the Mobot on it, and it mows the grass by itself. So I had one of those put in, and it worked good, but the thing is, you still had to watch it because there were kids in the neighborhood, and every time the darn bag filled up, you still had to empty it. Then you had to lift this heavy thing over the parkways, you know, every time you had a sidewalk or something. So it wasn't as practical as what it should have been, but it was still cool to sit out there and have a beer while your neighbor's busting his chops with his... and your grass cutter's going zip, 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 zip. So, I mean, I really had it all. And when we got married, we were on the very first plane ever hijacked to Cuba. July 1st, 1968, and we went straight to Cuba. And when we got there, they took us off the plane, and they brought us into a restaurant, and they sat us all down, and they gave everybody a beer, a bottle of beer. Well, I noticed that the flight crew, which was about seven people, weren't going to drink theirs, so I went over and I says, "You guys want your beers?" "No." So I collected their seven beers. And then there were a couple of nuns who weren't drinking, so I collected their seven beers. Then there were a couple of kids that weren't drinking, so I collected, and I had about 20 beers there. And she said to me, she says, "Ken," and I says, "Well, honey," I says, "we may be here several hours, you know." And I've got all these beers there, and then some guy comes over to me, and he wants to buy one. You know? So I says, "All right." My wife says, "What are you, some kind of a mercenary?" You know? But already an obsession, you know, had started, you know, with booze. My aunt, you know, my dad's sister aunt, my Aunt Maggie, was my favorite aunt. And she asked me that year, she says, "Kenny, what do you want for your birthday?" I says, "Demon rum, Maggie, demon rum." So we're at my birthday party, and I'm opening up this package, and I pull out a bottle of Hunter Poo Smirnoff. And she says, "Kenny, I went to about 12 liquor stores and nobody had Demon, you know." But she said, "The guy said that'll do, you know." So, I mean, I was already, you know, even though I don't think at that point in time, you know, I was an alcoholic, I was definitely predestined to become one because there was an obsession there. There was a thinking about alcohol. There was some kind of a joy about talking and kidding about it and everything else that I was experiencing, you know, at that point in time. And business was good. I had a beautiful wife. She was a teacher. She had become a teacher. And life was good. And then, you know, like Nick Clayton was saying, I became a Rotarian, Lion, JC, and all that stuff. And I wasn't just satisfied to be in those organizations. I had to be the president or the head of all these organizations. You know, never could be just an ordinary member. And what I hadn't realized is everything that I did, my work, those kinds of activities, I was still in the theater group, and I mean, everything involved booze. We drank at everything. And I didn't realize how it was creeping up on me. You know, I just didn't realize it. Because there just were never any days when I didn't drink. And I never really had any hangovers because I would usually start early enough the next day that I would never feel them. You know, I always looked good. I took care of myself. And it was sneaking up on me, you know, just as sure as heck. And I was in San Francisco for a meeting, and I was flying back on the airplane, and I wouldn't go anywhere unless it was first class, and I was sitting next to this gentleman from England, and he pulled out this little machine, and it was a little label maker, and I looked at it and said, "Oh, that's cute." It was the Dymo label makers, and he said, "Yeah," he said, "I just bought this company. I'd like to kind of get it going," and we talked and everything else. He says, "Boy," he said, "would you come to work for me, and I'll pay you, you know, twice what you're getting and this and that." And I says, "Well, look, here's the deal." I says, "I ain't going to go to work for anybody that I just met on the plane drinking martinis with." I says, "Let me check you out and then we'll talk." So I checked him out, and he sure was who he said he was. So I went to work for him. In those 2 years, we had those things everywhere in the country. We had them in Walmart. We had them with distributors, you know. Renee and I were talking, every electrical distributor in the country had them, you know, and we were making bigger ones and bigger ones. So we went to Detroit. We started selling directly to the manufacturer and then funneling them back through our distributors. We were making a mint on that stuff. And I once asked my boss, we were in Chicago at the Hyatt, and I says, Tony, I says, you think 3,000 is too much for breakfast? He says, not if you enjoyed it. Yeah. And that's where we were at, you know. In those days, it was acceptable. And when we had our meetings in that in the morning at 10 o'clock, instead of having a coffee break, they'd wheel in like these giant, beautiful bowls with flowers in the ice and everything else. It was screwdrivers, Bloody Marys, you know, and everything else. And the coffee pot would always stay full. Everybody'd be there with their screwdriver, you know. And this is at 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, this was our meeting break. Yeah, you know, these were the meeting breaks. And it just was, and I would notice that other people were drunk, but I was still somehow hanging in there. And I had come home from California. Our home office was in Berkeley. And I had come home to go to a play practice. And we had just had our son, Sean Patrick O'Block, and I was so proud of that boy, and he was only maybe 6 months old, but I actually came home to Chicago and went to play practice, and got on the plane and went back to California, and now the play practice was less than a mile from where my wife and child lived, and I guess within the ensuing day or so, my wife ran into one of the neighbors in the supermarket. And she says, well, it must have been nice to see Kenny the other day. Yeah, I know you had mentioned you hadn't seen him in a while. She says, what do you mean? And, you know, she found out that I was in town and didn't even call her, you know, a couple of blocks away. And when I got home, that was it, you know. She says, Ken, she says, I'm going to divorce you. I says, what? I says, what do you mean? I didn't do anything. And it took me a long time, even into my sobriety, to come to the realization that, you know, women do get married for other things, you know. You know, her house was not going to hold her. Her car was not going to kiss her. Her fur coats were not going to comfort her. You know, I was not there, you know. And she did not believe that I had any kind of problem with alcohol. I couldn't understand why I was getting divorced. And she just thought that I just didn't care about her. I mean, hell, I was never there. You know, I was never there. Even though I was faithful in that, I was never home. And that was a crowning blow when I had gone home and not done that. So I fought that divorce for a year and a half. And had the judge order counseling and everything else. And my lawyer, who I bought the office furniture for, Larry Capriotti, he says, Kenny, he says, here's the situation. He says, the woman does not want you. He says, you're just going to have to bite the bullet on this one, you know. And I says, okay, I guess we'll have to, you know. And he says, everything's going to be sold and split up. But he says, I want to tell you something as a friend. He says, Kenny, he says, you probably ain't going to like this. But he says, I think you got a really bad booze problem. I says, what? He says, just listen to me. He says, we've been friends for many years. He says, here's what I want you to think about doing. And I want you to think about it hard. He says, let's just say that the house was sold and you gave your half of the money to her for child support in advance. That way you won't have to worry about anything. And I says, all right, we'll do that. And thank God I did, because I let her keep everything and my child support was paid all the way until he was like 18. So because that she'd never got a dime, you know. Not that I didn't have it then, but believe me, it didn't take me long until I didn't. You know, after I got divorced, things went like a rocket ship right to the basement, because there were no curtails on me whatsoever. You know, before I had the weekend, sometimes you got to behave yourself when you're home and you have to kind of chill it down a little bit. Well, now it was just Kelly bar the door. You know, I just went wild. And During this time, my mother got sick and she passed away, and that bothered me immensely. And I decided what I needed to do was to retire. You know, I called my boss and I says, Ivan, I says, I worked all my life. And I says, my mother died, I got divorced, and you know, there's just better things in life, and I'm just gonna retire. I was 31 years old. And I had some money, but certainly not enough to retire on, but my mind at that point in time was so glazed over with booze that, you know, I certainly wasn't thinking straight. And he said, why don't you just take a leave of absence or something? I said, nah, I'm retiring. So I said, what do people do when they retire? They travel. So I decided, well, you know, I'd been to the West Coast a lot, but I had never been in the car. So I bought a new car, and I decided I would drive out west. So I'm driving out west, and I stopped at a little coffee shop in Tucumcari, New Mexico. And there was the cutest little gal behind the counter. And I said to her, I says, hey, how would you like to go to Hawaii? She says, you know how many guys come in here with this kind of crap, you know? And I says, this is different. She says, how so? I says, because this time you're going. You know? So I grabbed her and I actually pulled her across that restaurant floor, took her apron off and tossed it. I says, she ain't coming back. You know, so we got outside, she was laughing. She said, are you serious? I says, yeah, do you really want to go? She says, sure. So we hopped in the car and we drove and went to Las Vegas. And she said to me, she says, boy, it'd be nice if you had a convertible. I said, I can fix that. So I drove in and traded in the car. Now, in those days, you could do that for about, you know, $1,000 or something like that. So I just traded cars. Never bothered telling the insurance company I was switching cars or anything like that. Just did all this. Went to Los Angeles, parked the car, and went to Hawaii. And after we're there a day or so, I had one of those moments of, like, clarity where fear hit me. I says, my God, I hope she's 18. You know, I says, I'm probably wanted for kidnapping or something. So I looked at the news and the fear just kind of struck me, you know. So while she was down getting her hair done, and I just wrote her a note. I said, you can keep the clothes I bought you and here's some money and you got a return ticket and I'm sorry. And I took off. I freaked. And I just kept going. I was gone for, I don't know, 6 or 8 months and spent a ton of money and got back. And you know, and at that point in time, you know, we have all gone to the doctor with really worried that we may have something, only to find out when we got there it was nothing. So I decided that I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous to see if I had alcoholism. I was worried. So I went to a meeting and I was so relieved to find out that I didn't have it, you know, because I had never been to jail, you know, I hadn't done any of these things, you know, and I could still think, you know, and everything else. I was just so relieved, but I says, man, I probably ought to tone it down a bit, you know, because they told me that all this stuff, and then some, would happen to you, you know, if you were an alcoholic. Well, in the times that then passed, it just got really bad. I used to drink. I have two stories I like to tell because I told them the very first time that I ever talked, and I really, they just came out because they were things that I remember. They were so vivid because they were so stupid, and it showed the insanity that drink brings on you. And I had a place that I drank in Chicago called the 71 Club, and it was at the Executive House, and it was real close by where the office was when I was with the Diamond Match Corporation. And I would go in there, and two of my drinking buddies were, one of them was a famous Chicago disc jockey, and the other one was an infielder for the Chicago Cubs. And we would drink in there quite a bit. So we're in there drinking one day, and I had longer hair then. It was darker, and most of my life I wore a pencil then mustache. And the girl that was tending bar, she said to me, she says, finally, she's been looking at me, she says, I know who you remind me of, Errol Flynn. Now, Errol Flynn, I said to her, that's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. I says, Errol Flynn was always, always my favorite actor. I just loved the guy, you know. And I said, I'm going to have some fun with this. So I went out to the payphone. We didn't have cell phones in those days. And I called the theatrical place that was right close by, and I says, "He's got anything like a Robin Hood suit?" Or he says, "Yeah, we got all that." So I said, "I'll be right over to get it." See, so I went over and got this outfit and went in the washroom there and put it on. Went in the bar. Everybody goes, "It's Errol Flynn." You know, so I had, this was really a neat outfit. It had the, I had the brown leather boots, the green tights, you know, the quiver of arrows. I had the hat with the feather, the sword. Oh, it was cool, you know. So we're sitting there, and my one buddy said to me, he says, "Kenny," he says, "you're always the one that's telling me you got to seize the moment, you know." He says, "You don't have a job right now. You know, you got this, the outfit, and I want you to go out and be in the movies, you know." I says, "You know, Larry, you're right." So I went out to the phone and made a reservation for, on, you know, American Airlines to go to Los Angeles. I went in, dumped it down, finished my drink, got on the flexible bus out in front of the executive house and went up to O'Hare Field. And when I walked through the door, and in those days O'Hare was a lot different, I just walked through the door, and I'm walking towards the American Airlines ticket counter. You could see the eyes were just bugging out of their head. And I says, "You got a reservation for Kenny O'Block on the?" She says, "How are you going to pay for this?" I says, "American Express." Well, they took that card and they looked at it like, "This card is probably belongs to the guy he killed when he escaped." So they come over and they say, "Well, okay." And I signed the thing and they looked at me. They says, "Can't take that sword on the plane. Can't take those arrows either, you know." So they got all this stuff. And then they say, "You want to check that hat?" I says, "No." I says, "I love that hat, and I know that can't be illegal." It was just really neat. So we get on the plane, and they put me next to this little old lady, and she's over by the window, and I'm sitting by the aisle. Planes weren't really that full in those days. And she's just staring at me, you know, just staring at me. I says, "I know, you're wondering what I'm doing like this, you know." And I says, "Here's the situation." I says, "I'm going out to California to be in a movie." I says, "The person they hired turned out to be a drunk, and he didn't show up. So I have to go straight from the airport to the set, you know." So here I am on the plane, and I've got everybody laughing. In fact, a pilot came back down, you know. And he says to me, he kind of kneels down by the side of the seat there, and he says, "You know, if we had a stop, you'd be off on it." And I says, "What do you think, I'm a fake or something?" He says, "No, no, you're not a fake. You're a genuine idiot." Yeah. So when we got to Los Angeles, no one would rent me a car. And, you know, I'm going to turn them into their bosses and this and that, and why they wouldn't rent me a car. So in those days, the airlines had a little money, and they used to have people out in front of the counters. And one of them said to me, she says, "You know, why don't you just take a cab?" Well, that had never even occurred to me to take a cab. So I got in the cab, and I said, "Warner Brothers." So they took me to Warner Brothers, and I got out of the cab, and I walked right past security. Right, no one said a word to me, you know. And the next thing that I can remember, I woke up in this room with wrestling mats on the floor and the wall, you know, and I was in my underwear. And I thought, "Oh, man, you know, this certainly isn't the movies," you know. And it seemed like I was there a while, and in came two people. There was a lady, and she was dressed in a white coat, and she had her clipboard and everything else, and a great big Mexican fella, you know, like helping, I guess, in case I went nuts or something. I said, "She must be a doctor," I thought. And she says, "Good morning, Mr. Flynn." And I said, "Oh," I says, "my name's not Flynn." I says, "Yeah," I says, "I got drunk yesterday, and this started out as a joke, you know." So she says, "That's what we thought, but," she says, "we just had to bring you in here for observation." She says, "There are no charges against you." She says, "So we're going to let you go." She says, "But you have some money with you, so we sent someone out to buy you some blue jeans and a jacket and a sweatshirt. Now, you can't go back that way. You know, we wrapped her stuff up and everything else." So on they had two uniformed police take me to the airport. Now, I wasn't handcuffed or anything. There was a lady cop and a male cop, and they were both in their police uniforms. So we were sitting there waiting for the airplane, and the stewardess comes over, and she says, "Is there anything that we need to know?" And the cop says, "Well, just don't give him any drinks, you know." so when they called the flight, they gave me a hug and said, take care of yourself. And I get on the plane, and we take off going back to Chicago. And here comes the cart. And I'm thinking, man, I got to have a drink, because God only knows how long it's been now, and I'm really shaking. And they got to me, and I says, I'll have a double martini. She says, well, they said not to give you any. I says, they are right. I have to pay. She says, all good for you, you know. So I learned absolutely nothing from that, you know, and I was constantly trying to outwit everybody, you know, and I learned absolutely nothing from that. And, you know, I was having a hard time finding any kind of employment. And then one of my sisters called me up one Sunday morning. And she said, Ken, she said, do you have the Chicago Tribune? I says, yeah, why? She says, in the employment section on this page, she says, in this column over there, she told me, she says, you look down, she says, it is the perfect job for you. You could probably get hired immediately. So I looked in the paper. You know, I went to where she told me to look down. I looked down and I saw it. Wanted, experienced maniac. And then it was a misprint because you have to have your own tools, you know, and this and that. So they were looking for a mechanic, but I figured as long as I had the paper, I might as well look at it. You know, so I'm looking through there, and I see this one job. And Bill likes this story. They were looking for a chemical engineer, and it said their salary range, you know, 80 to 100,000. I said, that's a little bit more my speed. It's not what I want, but it's a little bit more my speed. So I says, chemical engineer. So I made a couple of phone calls and looked around, and I found out what the company did. And I went to the library, and I spent a whole day reading on metal finishing, anodizing, chromate conversion, coatings, and this and that, Diptech operations. And I went for an interview. And I told them I had a degree from IIT, and that, you know, this is what I knew, and this is what I could do for his company, you know, and this and that, and they hired me. They hired me. And I'm on the job about 2 weeks, and believe me, I know nothing, you know. I know absolutely nothing. I know more about the space shuttle than I knew about that, you know. And then... one day, they had a problem. One of our best customers, which was the Federal Sign and Signal Company, they make the bars that they put the Mars lights on for the fire department and the police department and everything else that go on top of the cars and trucks. And they were having a hard time getting the chrome to stick to the thing, and they were having problems with it, and that was what we did. So they sent me out there to test and see what the problem was. So I went with a crew of people, and I'm the one with the white hat that said engineer, and I go out there, and I've got this little test kit, and I'm testing this stuff, and believe me, I have no idea what I'm doing. I mean, I could have been making waffles or something, but it looked pretty good, and I had no idea how it would ever pull this off or anything. It just didn't even cross my mind, because I was just kind of functioning on a minute-to-minute basis, and I said, yeah, I says to Julio, who was the head of the crew, I says, dump a couple of barrels of that in, then we'll put another barrel of that in, then we'll try some of this, and then we'll put a little bit of that in. So the head foreman there, his name was Stasiu. He was a big Polish fellow, and he says, and he's looking at me, and Julio's looking at me, he says, hey, Mr. Kenny, he says, that stuff's getting awful mean, you know. And I said, all right, try it now. So he presses these buttons and overcomes his part, and it goes in there. I said, leave it in there a while, and it's bubbling and everything else. I says, okay, pull it out. So he pulls it out, and there's nothing there, you know. And the only thing there was half of a hook, and it was on fire. You know? And he says to me, he says, where's my part? And I says, just like sugar and coffee, you know. And I started laughing because the look on this guy's face was just worth a million laughs. And then the alarm goes off, and they go, phosgene gas, run for your life. So they opened up the walls of this factory and everything else, and everybody's out in the parking lot. So they sent for my boss and the company president and everything else, and they get out there, and they said, Kenny, come here. You know, let's go over to the Holiday Inn here and have a drink. We need to talk. I said, well, now you're talking. So we get over there, and we sat down, and he says, you know, we're going to have to let you go. I says, over something like that? He says, we can understand, you know, how maybe you wouldn't know how to fix the problem. But when something like this occurs, he says, we cannot laugh at our customer. He says, we're very fortunate that we're not looking at a crater over there, you know. And that's the kind of stuff that I was doing. And I had no thought about the consequences. Fortunately, no one got killed or hurt. But the plant was seriously damaged, and they had to shut it down. And some people lost some, I'm sure, some money, some wages from it. And it really was sad. It's funny, but I like to tell it because of how stupid and crazy that I had become. With just no idea at all how I was going to pull something like that off, or what the far-reaching consequences of that might be. You know, I know that we're getting closer, and I want to get into a little more into AA. At that point in time, you know, I decided that I really did want to do something about my drinking, and I went to the VA, and I had never used any my VA benefits in that. So I went to Hines Hospital, and I spent about 6 weeks there. And when I got out, a friend of mine who actually I'd served with in the service was a doctor there, and he had talked me into going to a halfway house. So I went to a halfway house, and I stayed there for about 6 or 7 weeks, and then I got out, and I got myself a job, and I went to AA, and I enjoyed going, and I was in a different environment because I stayed on the west side of Chicago, and I was able to put, you know, about a year, a little over a year sobriety together, and the company that I was working for, you know, asked me to move to Springfield, and during that time, though, I had met a gal that I had met years earlier at Hugh Hefner's house at a Playboy event. And she was Miss October of 1966, and I married her, you know, and in the program, and I moved her to Springfield, and she couldn't stand Springfield, and that marriage was over almost instantly. It was stupid to do, and she wasn't staying sober, and I didn't stay sober as a result of it, but I knew that I wanted, you know, what I had, and during that last slip that I had, I accumulated a bunch of DUIs, and I lost my license for 5 years. And I decided that was in Southern Illinois, that I would go back to Springfield. And the person that I actually had taken home from his first meeting ended up being my sponsor. And when I got in, I was really worried. I mean, at this point in time, you know, I didn't care whether I had another car ever. I didn't care if I ever had another girlfriend ever. I mean, I really did not care. The only thing I knew for sure is I was just could not live the way that I was living. I had reduced myself to where I had absolutely nothing, not one penny. I had sold absolutely everything I had ever owned that was dear to me for booze money. I had nothing left. So I came to Springfield and got an apartment and started going to AA. And I was so fearful that I would go back out. And in the beginning, what I had was the fortune of getting together what I call my support team. And I didn't really have one sponsor. I had 5 or 6 people who had 25 years plus. And I would constantly call these people and meet them. And you know, the fellow that was the dearest to me, his name was Joe, because when he came in, he couldn't spell Joe, so he would always say he was Joe, and he said to me, he says, Kenny, he says, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail, you know, who has thoroughly followed our path. He says, what does that mean to you? And I says, it means I need to, you know, to kind of watch you and do what you do. He says, you got it, and he says, you know, then what does it say there? And he says that, you know, until we let go, you know, absolutely, you know, the result's going to be nil. He says, that's where you're at. He says, in this moment, at this time, you're through. And I says, I agree. He says, that's all you need to do to start, you know. And, you know, that time has never come, you know, for me to go back out. He says, maybe when the time comes, if you're willing to listen, you know, and do what we ask you to do, that maybe that time will not come. And when it does come, maybe you won't, you know, and it just never did. I have stayed active over all these 27 years. I've sponsored people. I've been able to speak at different places throughout the country. I love working with newcomers. There's always a new experience. I go to the 1 o'clock meeting every day because we have newcomers every day. There was one young guy sitting out there a couple weeks ago, and I was there early that day, and we're sitting out in front, and he asked me if I could have a cigarette, and I gave him a cigarette, and he says, Mr. Kenny, he says, how long do you have to be in here before you're certified? And I says, well, I says, you certify yourself. I says, we don't do any certifying. We don't give you a card that says you're registered or certified alcoholic. I says, that's something you have to decide for yourself. I says, well, they said that I had to go here because I was a certified, or I was definitely an alcoholic. And he says, I don't have to register it. I said, no, no one's going to ask you your name. You know, if you want to tell us what your name is, that's fine. You don't need to ever tell us your last name. I says, you know, and if you don't even want to tell us your first name, say you're John or Bob or whatever you want. And I says, and just keep an open mind, you know, and now we get people in where one day there was a 12-year-old. And he says, you know, it's hard for me to say that I'm an alcoholic because I've never had a drink. And I says, well, I says, you know, you have to look at it this way. I says, that stuff you're taking is your alcohol. I says, you know, I drank liquid, you're taking solid. I says, there's no difference. You know, I says, we're here to help you. You know, things have changed over the years, and everyone that comes in now is dually addicted. I happen to be a pure alcoholic. I never smoked a joint in my life. I never took a pill. And we're kind of a dying breed. You know, I loved drinking. I loved everything about it until it practically killed me. It's important to know that the 12 steps in the program that was truly a gift from God was put down because it gives room to bend but yet not break. You know, we've adapted a lot of the things that we do, a lot of our treatment centers and that, to accommodate the drunk of today, because the drunk of today is not the same as the drunk of yesterday. The disease is the same, but a lot of the situations and things, you know, have changed over the years. And it was tough for me to realize that because I came from a bunch of old drunks where, you know, all we did is drink, you know. But everything happens in time, and I'm glad that I'm still a real active part of it. You know, I can't say enough about about what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for my life, what it's done for my family's life, and what it's done, you know, for me in my relationship with God. You know, I had served Mass until I was 20 years old. At one time, I even thought about being a priest. And I totally had lost it, you know, over the years. And I have now, you know, developed a sense of communication with the higher power, that of like which I have never known. You know, a lot of times I've never met the Pope, but I had been in Rome where the Pope had talked. And a lot of times I don't feel as close to God as I do right this morning in this room, you know, especially when I think about my mother and what a wonderful gift that has been. Today, I'm extremely fortunate. I have a wonderful son of my own. He's in the medical profession in a big hospital in Chicago. I have two marvelous stepsons who I've enjoyed immensely. You know, I've been able to do the things with them that I was not able to do with my own son because I didn't see him for many years, and I was not part of his rearing. But these two boys have been a godsend for me. You know, I have someone I watch football with, someone to go to the Green Bay games with, and my wife is just I really lucked out. For just one more time in my life, things did change to gold. You know, and that's when I found my wife. And she's a wonderful gal. You know, she's the apple of my eye, and she's one of the main reasons that I'm here. And she sees when we go out and so forth like that, and I introduce her to some of my friends, and she just sees the happiness in their faces, and that she's not in the program, she's not part of the program, but she participates for me, you know, with me, and she probably would have come today had it not been Mother's Day weekend, and she went to see her own mother, who's getting, you know, up in years, but I hope to bring her in the near future. Again, you know, in closing, I want to wish everybody a safe trip home. This has been truly a wonderful experience for me because I've been able to talk to just about everyone here. And again, I feel as though I've known you forever. You know, it's just a marvelous experience. And Milton was right. It is a very special place. You know, it is a very special place. And I consider myself extremely honored to have been asked to be able to speak here and to experience this firsthand. And, you know, and God bless you all. You know, God loves us drunks. And he gave us this as a very, very, very special gift, you know. And we're truly all blessed. And with that, I'll bid good day.